solve large, intractable problems.
It's a new venture altogether.
Your brain is a wild horse there.
Because remember, writing is not a team sport.
You are not selling horse carriages when there are cars.
I want to be known only as a trusted advisor.
More like a tourist.
Play to Potential Podcast.
And then to your point about what's been of disproportionate value, keep in mind, I went through multiple big transitions, right? I went like the decision to leave Google. I told you I had a failed choice that did not work out with Polyvore, my first startup, or the startup I went to after Google, where I took a big risk. And then obviously I, you know, evolved again when I became the CEO of StubHub. So the disproportionate value is the continuity. You know, if you give up on having a coach, let's say at year two, they haven't seen your cycles to reflect back to you. Number two, he has been a constant who's been with me through multiple management teams. He's somebody I can bring in who both has my history, but can help new people get to know me and navigate me, help me navigate them. So I've actually used him even as somebody to get my 360 feedback from, because my management teams know that I trust him. They know that they, and, you know, so they know that maybe if they want to give me feedback and they're too afraid to give it to me, you know, face to face, which sometimes leadership teams are, it doesn't matter how much you ask for it. They know that I'm providing them a conduit for somebody I trust who can hold their feedback and give it to me. So that history has a lot of value, right? You know, it helps with pattern recognition. So I'd say one of the biggest values has been like, it's one of my longest standing relationships beside my marriage. And it's somebody who can reflect back to me what I said 5 years ago, what can stitch together my own feelings of myself with like when I used him to get peer feedback or 360 feedback, being can stitch together other people's view of me and help give me a holistic perspective. And I know, and I think at the end of the day, this is the value of coaches. We know that, yes, we may be paying them, but their job is to help us be our best selves with no skin in the game other than our success.
Welcome to the 82nd Conversation at the Play to Potential podcast. I'm your host, Deepak Jayaraman, and this podcast is a labor of love for the long term, where I have conversations with leading practitioners, thinkers, authors, artists, sportsmen, and other leading professionals to decode insights around three themes: leadership, transitions, and careers. In addition to curating this podcast, I work with leaders with a growth mindset as a trusted sounding board, helping them and their organizations transform and play to their unique potential. To know more about what's in the podcast archives and the advisory work I do, you could just visit playtopotential.com. That's www.playtopotential.com. The guest of the podcast this time is Sukhinder Singh Cassidy. She's one of Google's and Silicon Valley's most respected leaders. She's worked at various tech and media companies, including Google, Amazon, News Corp, Yodlee, and Polyvore. At one stage, she was heading Latin America and APAC in Google in 2008, and she's credited with building Google's presence across 103 countries in Latin America and Asia Pacific. Sukhinder has recently authored the book Choosing Possibility, where she speaks about embracing micro risks as a process to unlock growth and professional fulfillment. Some of the themes we spoke about included the notion of the myth of a single choice, embracing risk as a discovery process, her experiences with her coach David Lesser, with whom she engaged for more than a decade, her take on Bill Campbell, the $1 trillion coach. She also shares candidly what went wrong when she transitioned from Google to Axel to Polyvore as an external CEO. She speaks about some of the challenges in getting senior leadership transitions right in the context of a scale-up. We also spoke about the notion of stepping into white spaces and how we should embrace who we are and marry it with market opportunity tailwinds to build a successful career. Without further ado, let's dive into the conversation with Sukhinder Singh Cassidy. Sukhinder, thank you so much for making the time to come on the Play to Potential podcast. Excited to be talking to you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Maybe just to kick things off, would love to know, why did you write this book, Choosing Possibility? And more specifically, of the various titles you considered, how did you pick this one?
Let me start with how and why I wrote the book. I wrote the book because I think that when you grow up at, or you, when you spend your career in a place like Silicon Valley, there's all sorts of myths that people sort of put upon this place that this place exacerbates. One is, you know, how entrepreneurial and risk-taking people must be. And I believe this perception that sort of we look from afar and we think that people are born risky, born as risk takers. They make one mighty choice that looks so well executed and so well orchestrated that we think that this, you know, this lucky and really perfect choice must be the reason for their, you know, outsized success. And when you're from within the place, you kind of see what a mess things can be and how things can look so perfectly orchestrated from outside and people can presume this sort of hero's journey that I talk about in the book. And from the inside out, it's just not that way. And so I wanted to write the book because I think that risk-taking is really accessible to most people and that making it accessible is a worthwhile endeavor. And so that's why I wrote the book.
Got it. And picking up from there, Sukhinder, you talk about the myth of the single choice, and you actually say that, you know, good careers are actually a result of a number of micro choices and smart risks people take. Just talk to us a little bit, maybe in the context of your journey, if you could give us a sense of what do you mean by these micro risks?
Sure. Well, I think the point in the book is that from outside in again, and from the media, we have this idea of the hero's journey and what, and even our own memories sometimes fail us, that what we extract from other people's journey and remember of our own is often like the single big choice, right? Which maybe in hindsight, maybe it's easier to identify one choice that was disproportionately important or what have you. But the problem is that like, it's through abstraction or through hindsight that you might be able to deduce or imagine one choice. The problem is like going forward through your life, it's about making choices. And it's the practice of continually choosing, like being in a feedback loop with yourself, essentially, throughout your career, not with a product, not with a company, but with as yourself, that often unlocks each next possibility, right? It's a choosing and choosing and choosing again. And some of these choices are smaller, some of them are bigger. And so while everybody else may remember the one, the reality is it wasn't the one. It was the several, and the several was the 10, and the 10 was the 20. And so it's not about the size of one single risk, it's about the frequency of risk taking and the commitment to sort of, you know, a journey of continuously choosing, including choosing through failure. You know, we think that the failure happens and we stop. Well, actually it doesn't. What happens is people keep choosing and then they reach their next cycle of growth. And obviously my career is probably part of where I took inspiration from. I'm not an academic, I'm a practitioner in business. And so in my career, I counted 23 different choices. To become the CEO of a large, you know, multi-billion-dollar company. And some of them were micro with outsized returns. Some of them were macro that, you know, created large failures. And some were, you know, macro choices that resulted in almost nothing at all, certainly not the impact I expected. So for me, it was the process of continuing to choose and some with often with unexpected results.
If I could pick up from there, you spoke about 23 choices. If you sort of maybe force rank them in the decreasing order of what people are likely to miss. You know, some choices are obvious. You go to B school, there's placements.
Yeah.
That's an obvious choice. You know, you need to decide. But there are, I'm sure there's a realm of, in the book when I read it, there were a bunch of things that probably isn't even in people's awareness that it's a choice. Could you talk a little bit about those vital few, which are worth bringing back to our entire awareness.
Sure. And I think that I'm happy to talk about two or three or four from the book that kind of highlight or illustrate this point. One unobvious choice was I left Google at the pinnacle of my career to become the CEO of a startup that was, you know, and at the time I was running Asia Pacific and Latin America for Google. It was a multi-billion dollar business. I was certainly on track to be a Fortune 50 or 100 CEO if I think I wanted that path. And what I really wanted to do was to prove I could build and scale another company and be the CEO then. Like I didn't want it later, I wanted it then. And I wanted it, you know, and I wanted to go to a new area of innovation in e-commerce. And so I walked away from a very large job to become CEO of a startup. And I think people would say, well, that's not an obvious choice. I don't think it was. And that choice failed when measured by the next 6 months. And I will say this to people. I'm like, you know, 6 months later, I was in a battle with the founder and he wanted the company back and he won. I mean, the board, he said, the board, I want to be CEO again. And the board was pretty quick to oust me in favor of him, despite the fact that my resume, my accomplishments, all of that was quite large. But if you measure that choice 10 years later, I pivoted into e-commerce. I became a CEO. I thought that would be the company I'd be, you know, running as a multi-billion dollar company. It ended up with the choice. The number of choices I had to make subsequently continued to double down on this idea of being in e-commerce. I decided to start another company in e-commerce. I became an investor. I became a board member in e-commerce. I just doubled down on that thesis area. And that and the choice to be a CEO were the right ones. I mean, I loved the last 10 years of my life just being in charge. And I ultimately ended up running StubHub, which was another multi-billion dollar e-commerce opportunity. But I just didn't get there the way I thought. So that's one example. Another unobvious choice. I moved to Silicon Valley in 1997. By the way, I did not think I was making the grandest of choices. I thought I was making a choice to go live in a place with really good weather that had good entrepreneurs. I didn't know how to be an entrepreneur, but I think I thought I wanted to be. I didn't have an idea. And literally, I fell in love with the weather and the idea that there were people who were, you know, starting companies. But I could not at any scale of imagination have imagined how good the timing was of that choice relative to the growth of the internet, you know, just where it was in its inflection point. So it gave me many, many, many opportunities to succeed and many to fail. But honestly, what do we call that term in the US? It's like shots on goal, like too many shots on goal. You could fail one and there'd be another good shot on goal just right around the corner by virtue of putting yourself in an environment with tailwinds that are bigger than you imagine. So that was maybe an unobvious choice. I quit my job and I thought I was making a micro choice, not a micro choice, but you know, size, it was like, it's not that big a risk. I was only responsible for myself. I had some money in the bank. I didn't find, you know, a good job in California. I would go home to my parents in Canada and live with them. Like I don't, you know, other people say that's a big risk. I'd say relatively actually quite a small risk, but with outsized returns. That's an example in the opposite direction. So those are just a couple. And there are many more.
If I may pick an example that stayed with me, I think very early on in your career, you talk about, I think, some bank which says maybe we'll consider you in the future. And you sort of, you take that as an opportunity rather than a rejection and you call them and then it turns into an internship.
It turned into my first job. I definitely was trying to become an investment banker on Wall Street. And I failed at, you know, I failed to get the job after many, many interviews and almost a year of trying. And I think what you're referencing is they sent me a quasi-rejection letter, a bank that didn't, Merrill Lynch, which didn't recruit in Canada, but, you know, was arguably one of the biggest investment banks in the world. I had applied and they had sort of said, if you're ever in New York, we'd be happy to give you a 15-minute informational interview, which is a very polite rejection letter. And my father was the one who said, hey, buy a train ticket and go. Take them up on that offer. I'm like, they're rejecting me. He's like, well, still show up to say, I am actually going to be in New York. I will come in and see you. And I did. And that converted into a 3-hour interview. And that converted into an offer after a year of getting rejected through all the traditional processes. So yeah, yet another risk that maybe worked out in ways I didn't imagine, right? But it was kind of continuing to choose possibility that kind of led to that opportunity.
The other piece you talk about, Sukhinder, is you say that sometimes we think about taking risks only once we know for sure what we want to do, but actually risk taking is a way of seeing what makes sense, right? It's an opportunity to discover what we might like and where we are good at. Can you talk a little bit about risk as a discovery process?
Sure. I think that the world has trained people to believe you need to have a perfect plan before you have, quote unquote, the right to act. Which I think is somewhat ridiculous. It's sort of like people want to make a choice without having maximized their choices. Does that make, and so I was like, well, if you think that risk taking begins when you have to make a choice, I would say that's actually the riskiest move of all. Don't you want to take risks to discover what your choices are? it's ironic because, you know, if you look at you didn't go to college in the United States, right? And I didn't either. But when I watch the process of discovery children take in the United States to maximize their college choices, it's like the art of risk taking. Yet no other time do they do that, right? They're like, they apply to safety schools. They apply to the most prestigious schools. They apply for course X. They apply for course Y. They do it all in parallel. It's like beautiful. But yet when it comes to any other major choice in our life, we're like, I don't have time to look. Somebody just offered me this opportunity. Should I say yes? And then we somehow, you know, reverse ourselves and we take these big risks, like a one out of one risk. So I don't think risk taking for discovery is one of the best sets of risks to take. You're just putting, you know, putting out feelers, using little swaths of your time and energy to even discover all the things that might be possible before you make one choice. So I think of risk taking as maximizing choices even before we choose which risk to take.
Hmm. And you also talk about the notion of choice after a choice while mm-hmm. making a decision. I found mm-hmm. that phrase interesting. Can you talk a little bit about what you mean by that and how that can help us make better decisions?
Mm-hmm. Sure. Well, in the book, I have this kind of very basic formula that I certainly had in my mind that I think is a simple way to think about whether or not we're going to get into action on a new choice. I call it FOMO over fear. You'll act. Fear over FOMO, you won't. So people say, what does that mean? I'm like, well, when we visualize the positive, we have this fear of missing out on a new opportunity. That's often what's galvanizing us to take action towards a new choice. But standing in our way is our fear of failure, right? And so it's very clear, if the size of your fear of failure is greater than the size of your FOMO, no matter how big your FOMO, your kind of positive visualization, if the fear is even bigger, you just won't act. And if the reverse is true, you're likely to get into action. So most people think, well, I'll just visualize the positive. I'll just visualize the positive. For me, visualizing the positive alone is not that comfortable. For me, I like to pre-mortem and say, okay, how do I size appropriately the fear I have right now so I can shrink it? Or actually, quite frankly, just put it in context. So I always say with any choice you're contemplating, think about the choices after the choice to fail. Just think about the failure state. Pre-mortem it, not postmortem, pre-mortem it, and say, okay, if I made this choice and it fails, what happens then? And if you have many choices after the choice, chances are it's not a big risk, right? Like you should size down your fear of failure, because if you can imagine the many choices and even say, what would I do in all these worst case scenarios? If many are available to you, it's probably a smaller size risk than you think. And for me, that not only helps me, you know, shrink in my head the size of the risk to its actual size, but it also gives me the comfort to act, because once I know that I have thought through the failure state and I have 4, 5, 6 choices of what I could or should do or would be available to me, I actually feel some control over, you know, my ability to respond to any situation. And then I actively feel less failure, fear of failure. So that's what we call the choice after the choice, which is like, look through the choice that fails that you fear so much, look through to the failure state. And ask yourself how many choices you still have available. And if the answer is a lot, that should give you the comfort you need to act.
It's interesting that even in the way you look at the worst case scenario, it's not so much about the payoffs, but it's about the pathways that it generates. So even there, you frame it as a lookout for possibility as a way of making a decision rather than focusing on the payoff.
I think so. Because I think, unfortunately or fortunately, living in Silicon Valley, and here I do see that you don't know which choice is going to pay off. Like you can never take 100% of the uncertainty out of any indicator. What we can do is make educated guesses. And of course, I make very educated guesses about risk. But what we can't do is know exactly which one's going to pay off. And this is why thinking through the possibilities, even of the downside case, is something that gives me comfort.
Got it. The other theme we focus on this podcast, Sukhinder, is about how people make work choices and life choices. In mm-hmm. one of the sections of the book, you speak about you use the term negotiations with your husband about having a third child while wanting to be a tech company CEO. Mm-hmm. I guess asking a broader question, how have you thought about some of your choices around work and your family life, especially around maternity, which I find to be a point of leakage in the pipeline of women rising to the top? So how have you thought about that at various points in time?
Well, I think that maybe the way I've thought about it, that in hindsight, I realize is different than a lot of women or other leaders that I didn't necessarily see, but more so women who actually research shows are more risk averse. Like there is research to support that, you know, that claim. I guess I have never thought of it things as binary, and therein has been my ability to get through. Does that make sense? So I've never thought it's all work, it's all home. If I make a choice for this, it's a choice against this. By the way, there's sacrifices all around. I always say someone is unhappy with me. So that is absolutely true. What is absolutely true is there's no balance. Somebody is always getting disappointed. My family is like, you put so much energy into work. My, you know, people at work might be like, what? You're not available at this time because you're going to your daughter's water polo game. Like, I need more of you. And I'm like, well, there's only so much. So it is true that you get fairly, used to the fact that you're always disappointing someone, and thus there's some guilt there. But that aside, I think the key for me has always been like, don't presume something is impossible unless you first fully negotiate it at home or at work. And so, because when women say it's not possible, and by the way, that doesn't mean you have to want it. Like, there are severe trade-offs you make. So I'm not the person to say to women, you have to want it, this lifestyle. No, that's not what I'm saying. But I'm saying, if you want it, don't presume it's not possible until you negotiate to the nth degree what is possible. So get it to the best possible state through negotiation, as opposed to saying, I opt out. Because when you opt out without having a conversation, you don't know what's possible. So you may or may not be familiar. When I was at Google, I got married late. So I was 34 when I got married. Not late in today's era, but for an Indian woman, late. But certainly by the time I got married, I was senior at Google. But by the time I was pregnant with my first child, which was 35, I was already, you know, very senior, and I was running APAC and LATAM. And I thought, how can I possibly do this? But I really want to stay in this job. I'm just getting started. So I went to Google and I said, I would like you to pay for my nanny and my daughter to travel with me around the world. This is how I stay in this job. And to their credit, they said yes. They looked at the opportunity cost of losing me. By the way, not an ideal choice. My husband was left at home alone for ages, but better than giving up my job, better than my daughter being at home without me and being a mother who is like absent all the time, right? So he got the shortest end of the stick. We were all gone for weeks at a time. You know, 2 weeks at a time, the house would be empty because my daughter and I and the nanny were gone. But at least we were together as a unit when she was a newborn. But I didn't know that was possible. Like, that was something I brainstormed at home and took to work. And then the converse is also true, as we talked about. Like, later in my career, I wanted to be a tech CEO. And my husband thought, like, how do we have time for a third child? And we spent a year talking about how to have a third child. Because I also said, you know, not having a third child will be one of the biggest regrets of my lifetime. Like, I can't imagine it. So let's just keep talking it through until we get to a compromise where it's possible. And then we architected the support we would need to make it possible.
And actually, building on that, Sukhinder, I guess a prerequisite for that is some level of self-awareness about what we really want. You know, sometimes... As you go through these roles, what's been your approach to get to the bottom of what you really want?
That's a tough one, right? Because sometimes what we want evolves as we go. So we think we know what we want, and then we end up in a situation and are like much happier than we thought or much unhappier than we thought. So like anyone else, I would say I've probably learned self-awareness of who I am earlier than what I want. And what I want has evolved. And I think we learn self-awareness of who we are by asking for feedback. And if not, like, you know, lots of people don't get regular feedback in their jobs, like literally turning to the people we know and being curious enough to say, like, you know, you're my best friend. What do you think I'm good at? Like, where do you see me shine if you don't know the answer? So I think that I've had pounded into me as an executive all the things I'm not great at and great at because I've had lots of reviews. So I think that kind of self-awareness is easily more gettable. The kind of like what's at the root of our desires, I don't know, that's been an evolution for me, honestly. And I think it's just been about talking it through. And this saying in the book I really like from one of the stories in the book, Nick Gruden, who runs partnerships at Facebook. And he talked about like, I discovered who I was on the way, you know. Mm-hmm. And so I think I am one of those people. So I don't say I think I've had always known my level of ambition. I don't think I've always known exactly, you know, what would make me happy. But I think, you know, it's like anything, you know, every time I went through an experience, I learned more about myself. So I think I maybe have spent more time on self-awareness of maybe who I am than what I want, because what I want has kept evolving as I've learned kind of from every experience. So maybe that's not a pat answer, but that's the truth.
And you talk about your journey with David Lesser, your coach, in the book. And you talk about, I think at some point you say that you worked with him for a decade or more in your journey with him. As a practicing coach, I'm curious about, you know, what that journey looked like for you, you know, without getting into the confidential.
The nitty gritty.
What has been of disproportionate value to you? You know, sometimes you do a lot of things, but one or two things stand out. So I'd love your reflections on that.
Sure. So first of all, I found David through YPO because as I ascended to Google and became a leader, I also found that I wanted a tribe of people I could talk to. That is the promise of YPO, that you find similarly minded peers and you're in a discreet and confidential forum. First of all, I'd say my first learning that led me here is trying to make your spouse your work priest. Like, I'm not a fan. Like, maybe it's because I put so much on my own husband. And by the way, he is, you know, as you can tell, I wouldn't have this career without having a very supportive spouse. But supportive doesn't mean that they're meant to, like that we're meant to use our marriages, you know, to drain all the energy out of them by, like, putting them through all our work anxieties. And I think that's actually a lot what happens. Like, you just take energy from one sphere, right? And you drain it. And so whenever I'm obsessed with work, I've learned that if I want to put that into my marriage, it's actually a way to a really, you know, not a great two-way giving relationship. So what led me into YPO was like, look, how do I not put this all upon my spouse and find a peer group to talk to? And inside of that, I learned that while I liked YPO, it was taking a lot of time, but I really liked the coach who was coaching our forum. It was David Lesser. And I was like, could I just work with you directly? This seems a lot more efficient. And luckily he said yes. So that's how I found him. And then to your point about what's been of disproportionate value, keep in mind, I went through multiple big transitions, right? I went like the decision to leave Google. I told you I had a failed choice that did not work out with Polyvore, my first startup, or the startup I went to after Google where I took a big risk. And then obviously I, you know, evolved again when I became the CEO of StubHub. So the disproportionate value is the continuity. You know, if you give up on having a coach, let's say at year two, they haven't seen your cycles to reflect back to you. Number two, he has been a constant who's been with me through multiple management teams. He's somebody I can bring in. He both has my history, but can help new people get to know me and navigate me, help me navigate them. So I've actually used him even as somebody to get my 360 feedback from, because my management teams know that I trust him. They know that they, and you know, so they know that maybe if they want to give me feedback and they're too afraid to give it to me, you know, face to face, which sometimes leadership teams are, it doesn't matter how much you ask for it. They know that I'm providing them a conduit for somebody I trust who can hold their feedback and give it to me. So that history has a lot of value, right? You know, it helps with pattern recognition. So I'd say one of the biggest values has been like, it's one of my longest standing relationships beside my marriage. And it's somebody who can reflect back to me what I said 5 years ago, what can stitch together my own feelings of myself with like when I use him to get peer feedback or 360 feedback, he can stitch together other people's view of me and help give me a holistic perspective. And I know, and I think at the end of the day, this is the value of coaches. We know that, yes, we may be paying them, but their job is to help us be our best selves with no skin in the game other than our success, no politics. Other than, you know, it's just like a very pure relationship. And so I appreciate that. Like, I appreciate having somebody in my corner with whom I can be completely authentic, who has no other vested interest other than my success. And who I also trust to give me feedback, right? Like, I trust they have my goodest, best intentions. So I think it's a conduit for us as leaders. I think that a great coach is a conduit for us to learn about ourselves, probe ourselves, challenge ourselves. And that's why I like the history and tenure in that relationship that has had given me disproportionate value.
Got it. And if I may stay with this, Sukhinder, any rituals or any practices that you do with your coach, which has really stood out for you, which has been of significant value?
Well, it's not like we, you know, sometimes he just listens and lets me rant. I don't know that we have particularly, like, I don't think we always go to this ritual, but there are a few. David is actually very good at making you, I know it sounds hokey, but it's very true, making you talk to your inner self. So as I said, David will like take all the parts of you. And I think some of our rituals are always about like separating out the different identities I have. And I really like that with David. So David knows, for example, that, you know, as I said, one of the things he called forth very early on is like my inner risk manager. When I was making choices, he's like, literally, let's have a conversation with your inner risk manager. I'm like, what are you talking about? He's like, no, you're going to sit in this seat and talk to the part of yourself that's scared as the part of yourself who's ambitious and literally have a conversation, you know, with these two different identities. That's one example. Another is he knows that I was raised in a fairly religious family. So I was raised by two Sikh parents and I consider myself pretty religious. And so like, I literally, Like there's a part of me that believes that work is soulful and purposeful. And I believe that the way I'm going to show up in the world and have an impact may be through business. And I fundamentally think those things are intertwined. They may not be for, but for me, that's what I saw practiced from my parents. You know, they were, their purpose and their vocation were the same thing and their impact in the world. So I can have, like, I can literally have a conversation with David. He's like, well, you know, what would your father say? What would your, you know, like, if you think about the spiritual side of you, what would it say? So I appreciate that he is somebody who can disaggregate my separate identities and let them talk to each other as I try and make work choices. So that's been something pretty unique in our relationship. And I appreciate it about him. There are other coaches who may not be the same way, but for me, trying to bring all of myself to everything I do and somebody who recognizes those different competing parts of myself has been, it's been a gift.
Lovely. Actually, moving, staying with the theme of coaching, you also talk about your conversations with Bill Campbell at some point. And I did speak to one of the authors of The Trillion Dollar Coach on his methods. But staying in the theme of coaching, if you shine the light on your conversations with Bill, any reflections on what difference it made to you? And what he did? And what about him that stands out for you in your experience?
Yeah, of course. So for those of you who don't know Bill Campbell, I mean, you know him because you interviewed Jonathan or Alan or Eric, I don't know which, on Trillion Dollar Coach, Alan Eagle. And Bill Campbell's reputed, obviously, for having, you know, coached executives and leaders from Steve Jobs to Eric Schmidt on building, you know, companies literally with trillions of dollars. So Bill at the time was coaching a lot of executives at Google. He's been, you know, several days a week at Google. And I was one of the lucky executives who was also introduced to him for coaching. And Bill was different than David because Bill is an ex-NFL coach. And so, you know, first of all, I think he brought the art of management to the Valley. Very few people in the Valley. Hmm. The Valley is very slave to sort of founder culture, right? But it's not very, like, for a long time, it didn't put any store in being a good manager, you know, being good at management. And Bill was the first person to really, like, you know, make that desirable. Like, so first of all, I give him credit at a macro level far beyond me. But for me, he was like more of like a warrior coach. You know, there were times at Google where I would be frustrated. I had the region between Brazil and China. So it was a massive region. It was very disproportionate, disaggregated, you know, countries, countries in which we were losing badly, like China, Japan, Korea. And then countries that even if we were winning were fraught with complexity. India had its complexity, so did Brazil, what have you. And so many times I would look at my counterparts at Google and I thought they had it so easy and my team was working so hard and we had always a mess of some kind to deal with. But, you know, Bill's influence on me was that, you know, at times it was just sort of like calling forth my warrior self and stop looking at everybody else and like thinking about what they have and, you know, think about what you have and what you're building. And, you know, one of the phrases he taught my team that stayed with me sort of like, he's like, Sukhinder, like, you should be proud of your team. They're the team with all the dirt underneath their fingernails, you know, like, so instead of like, you know, bemoaning that you don't have it as easy as someone else, just think about what you guys are building. Think about like, you know, what you put into it, like value the grit. And that's the kind of coach Bill was. Like he was different things for different people and he could call it forth. For me, he kind of called forth like that warrior energy, that stop complaining, like, you know, harness it energy. And I really loved that part about him. But, you know this from different people in our lives, we get different types of energy and coaching. Mm. And so Bill brought a very unique coaching style to me, which I appreciated.
Got it. I think building on that, one of the terms Alan uses is Bill was a cheerleader, you know, the leaders that sometimes when you're in the thick of things, you sometimes lose track of the number of things going right. And one of the things he would say was Bill would just sometimes even stand in the boardroom and applaud and spur people on. So
absolutely. Well, Bill also had a twinkle in his eye all the time. And I think to your point, while he was like, saying to me, be proud of your grit. For sure, he was a cheerleader for my organization inside of the bigger Google. And I remember that too, you know, and being holding us up is like, you know, look at what that team is doing. And so you're absolutely right. He was tough love, but also the best cheerleader. That's absolutely true.
This is your host, Deepak Jayaraman here. Earlier in the podcast, I had the opportunity to speak with Alan Eagle, one of the co-authors of the book Trillion Dollar Coach that describes the methods of Bill Campbell. One of the themes he speaks about is how Bill was an evangelist of courage for his coachees.
You know, one of my favorite anecdotes from our book is we were talking to Clay Bavor. Clay is a VP here at Google. He oversees our VR and AR products, virtual reality and augmented reality products. And at the time that this story took place, Clay was a product manager, and he was just starting to work on AR products. And he was showing an early VR products. He was showing an early product to the Google board. So he was kind of nervous. He's up in front of the Google board and he's demonstrating this thing, and they're all wearing the goggles and trying them out. And he's trying to walk people through this demo, and something went well. And he hears this clap from the back of the room, like boom, 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 like loud cheering. And it's Bill Campbell cheering him on. And Clay said that moment gave him such confidence and such a boost. And think about it, how often when you're in a meeting and something goes well, or someone on your team does something well, you say, you know, like, good job or something like that, of course. But how often do you like, yeah, man, stand up and clap? You don't, because it doesn't feel right. But that's what Bill would do. So that's part of being an evangelist for courage, is really cheering people and celebrating their successes. And there's an interesting sort of tactical component as well. When we were talking to one of the Apple board members, I don't recall, he talked about how Bill would do this in an Apple meeting as well. Eddie Q told us about how Bill did this when he was showing the Apple board the Apple Play Store for the first time, and how Bill was like cheering and saying, this is so awesome. And it also sort of gets momentum going in the room if you want to make a decision that way. It's pretty hard to decide against or argue against something when someone has literally stood up and cheered for it. So, you know, there's a tactical aspect as well. But mostly this concept of being an evangelist for courage, it's just this idea of blowing confidence into people, just trying to boost them up, make them think they can do more than they think they can do.
For more, you can tune into the conversation with Alan Eagle about the Trillion Dollar Coach at the guest section at playtopotential.com. You might also like the playlist on coaching that you can find in the curated playlist section at the podcast. If you're deriving value from the podcast, do take a moment and leave a review on Apple Podcasts. It will really make a difference given the boom in the podcast supply. It will help listeners discover this podcast from the ocean of content that's out there. It will also help guests build trust with the podcast as they think about whether it's worth their time. Now, let's get back to the conversation with Sukhinder Cassidy. And you speak about transitioning from leading a 2,000-odd member team at Google to Polyvore after a short stint in Axel. Can you talk about that transition? And the reason I ask is, in India, we are going through a tech boom like the rest of the world, I guess. And we have several companies that are scaling up, that are recruiting senior executives from established corporations. Not that Google is an established corporation, but I'm curious about your learnings from transitioning from an established organization to a founder-led startup. What is, with the benefit of hindsight, what are some of the themes that emerge?
Sure. So a couple thoughts. So first of all, before I went to Polyvore, I had been a founder who had a CEO at my company who I helped recruit at Yodlee. And worked with him for 5 or 6 years. So I feel like I had lived the life of a founder who had an external CEO. So I had a lot of empathy for it. By the way, after I left Polyvore, just an aside, I literally emailed Anil Arora, who's the CEO of Yodlee, and I said, I just want to say to you, thank you for dealing and putting up with me when I was a founder. Like, let me tell you, on the other side, to be the CEO to a founder, holy smokes. So after Polyvore, I emailed him and just was like, thank you. Like, when I think about what I just went through, you dealt with me for like 5 years, and like very gratefully, now I like take my hat off to you, because I was in the same place, not nearly so gracefully. So that just is an aside. But obviously, just to be clear, I went from Google to Excel because I wanted to learn e-commerce and study all the available choices before I picked one. So Excel was, I was a CEO in residence. I sat in on investments, and I specifically said, I think I want to go do e-commerce next. I'd like a perch. So that was what I did at Excel. That was one of my preparations for Polyvore, honestly, was like, let me learn the industry. When I was specifically going to Polyvore, I would say in some ways, I tried to be as savvy as I could. That didn't, again, risk is risk. You can never take it to zero. I knew the founder. This was the first time he was going to have a CEO. So David Lesser and I literally, you know, talked about like, what could I do to ease his fears? We agreed that in the first 3 months, I would just listen and try and say nothing. Like not nothing, but just listen and hold it, right? So I said to David, I'm going to need you in this transition. David also coached me on how to approach the board because the board had a relationship with Pasha. And I remember when I kind of met with the board, I was like, look, I don't want to take Pasha out of a relationship with you. That will never work. So let's just agree that we will have a dialogue. I'm like, I know he's going to call you. Like you guys have been working together for many years, right? So I'm the new factor in this equation. So let's just agree that, you know, he'll keep meeting with you and that's great. I don't want to cut off that access. I mostly just want to be able to have a dialogue with you about what's going on. So I tried to establish my own kind of channels with the board without saying like everything goes through me, right? Because I knew this is a founder. And then I established like, you know, the third thing I did, I was like, Pasha, let's just go to coffee once a week. You know, so these are some of the tactics I used. By the way, you may say, what's the value of these tactics if you didn't end up, you know, having it work out? But I think in all ways, what I tried to do was create room for the founder to not feel like I, you know, was trying to assert my control over him. I mostly just thought like, you're good at all the things I'm not good at. You're a world-class engineer, you know, and have great product sensibility. I go to market and I've worked with, you know, and I had been a business founder to 5 engineers at Yodlee. I'm like, you know, I know, like, I know what I know. I know what I don't know. And I'm really good at harnessing teams. So I would say my learning is I don't mean this to be arrogant. I don't think I did anything wrong. I think I created a plan to try and, you know, hold his energy next to my own and not be in competition. I said multiple times, this is like a marriage. So, you know, what makes a marriage work? It's like you both want your kids to go, you know, grow up and go to IIT or to Harvard or to whatever. The point is like you have a common long-term goal and that keeps you in when the times are really tough. That's the way you have to approach something like this. It's like, but I'd say my learning is, and this is maybe more the learning for everybody out there, you can have all the best tactics. If your values overlap with the person which you're in, you know, and your self-awareness and their self-awareness is not high, it is like, it's a hard marriage to make work. So a CEO-founder marriage is a very unique kind of marriage, or quite frankly, COO-founder, but CEO-founder is much harder because you're like, you both have a kind of moral authority over the company and you don't want to be in battle with each other, right? Where the company's literally being torn apart by the founder saying one thing and the CEO saying another. But I'd say it's like a marriage. You both have to have a pretty high amount of self-awareness, some decent amount of humility on the things you don't know, a commitment to some communication vehicle when things are really tough. And most of all, common values. And ultimately, the founder and I did not share common values. And, you know, I talk about that in the book. He can be world-class, I can be world-class. Our values overlap was not there. And maybe that's the thing I regret. I was like, was there a way for me to discern, you know, like, you know, what our value systems are? And they weren't the same.
And reflecting on that, Sukhinder, for leaders that are at the cusp of making a transition who are deciding between choices, what's been your experience in understanding the value systems of your destination? You know, whether it's the organization or the leader, any reflections on that to minimize post-purchase dissonance, if you will?
Yes, exactly. No, it's true. By the way, I think it's so much the values of the who, not of the company, because at the leadership level, and I know a lot of your audience is leaders, right? So
yes,
you're totally competent. Like no leader fails because they don't have the competency to do the job. It's often culture fit and also culture fit with the rest of the leadership, even more than the company, right? The people you're going to battle with every day are, you know, the CEO, the other leadership team members on whom you're intrinsically dependent. So I often say when I think about where I've succeeded, it has been the values overlap with the leader who, here's what I look for. I look for skills that are diverse from my own. I fundamentally believe that you win when 1 + 1 + 1 = 3. But when you look for values that are congruent, there's a bunch of ways to discern them. Number one, ask them what their values are. Just be like, what are your top 3 values? You know, it's amazing what people reveal about themselves when you just ask them. Number two, ask the people who work with them. I always say when I'm asking people who work with them, you know, and I try and say the respectful way, I'm like, you know, when you think about what are your best interactions with this person, and then like, if I'm going to work with a CEO, I might say like, hey, what are the things you're going to do that are going to drive me crazy? And I'm like, I expect you to ask me the same question. So sometimes I want to tease out from all the people who work with someone, like, you know, where do you get energy from? What drains your energy in those interactions? Back channels, I definitely do. I just want to understand, like, you know, what are this person's strengths and development areas? And then, of course, today we live in a world where, honestly, so much information on how people participate is public. Reputations are small. If a leader has burned bridges a dozen different ways to Sunday, it is easily discoverable. I mean, we live in a world that's so small. If you're a leader, you can get on LinkedIn and find five people who know the person you're talking to. And quite frankly, at least two or three who've worked with them. You know, if it's not 1 degree, it's 2 degrees. And you really want to understand. So obviously the telltale signs of better leaders, yes, a healthy organization, which whose values you admire. You know, company values are often a reflection of a leader. That's true. The talent they've been able to attract, you know, and retain. That's another, you know, good indication. But like I said, sometimes there's no substitute for asking directly, and then the observed behaviors and their reputations. But I think you have to go into any equation knowing what your values are. Does that make sense? And I think I've learned some very painful lessons in what my values are in hindsight.
This is your host Deepak Jayaraman here. Nandan Nilekani, one of the co-founders of Infosys, has an interesting take on this in the context of co-founder selection. He speaks about lining on the timelines for which leaders are able to postpone gratification.
First is that you must share common vision. You must share a common value system. You must share a common desire to postpone your gratification for another day. Because building companies, especially building companies to last, is not a sprint, it's a marathon.
Right.
So if your partners are short-term oriented, your partners want quick rewards, if your partners have ethical issues, it doesn't work.
The time frames need to...
Everybody should say, okay, we're willing to defer rewards for a decade. That's a big ask. So I think the big lesson in Infosys was that, and Murthy had done a great job in assembling the people, the fact that all of us were united in a common vision to create a global company. All of us were united that you're going to do a very ethically run company with clear standards of ethics and corporate governance. And that we are willing to defer gratification for decades if required. That was the binding glue. And the fact that we put the vision above any of us. So I think getting the right founders is very important from a vision, values, time frame of gratification point of view.
It's a very nuanced point that Nandan makes here. How we think about postponement of gratification often depends on spousal preferences, stage of life, kids' education, parental context, and several other elements that might drive our financial trade-offs in life. Aligning on this explicitly, or discerning or looking for it explicitly, in addition to the things that Sukhinder speaks about, might be a good idea as leaders come together in the context of a startup. Now, let's get back to the conversation with Sukhinder Cassidy. In the book, moving on, Sukhinder, you talk about this notion of stepping into the white space and delivering, right? Can you talk a little bit about that? I like the phrase, stepping into the white space. Can you expand on that for us?
Sure. And I'll try and hit again on how it applies to leaders. I see many people who think that their biggest point of impact is doing their own job really well. Let me say that again, doing your own job really well. You know, we live in a world of specialists. I grew up in biz dev and sales. You grew up in a different field, but we all grow up as specialists of some kind before we become general managers. And even, you know, until the CEO suite, one could argue you're a specialist. You're in a functional lane. So often you get really smart people who think excellence and impact is about doing their thing extraordinarily well. Yet we all, as leaders, all of us, are frustrated when you can take a group of A players and put them in a room and, you know, say, okay, we're on our way to, we're trying to, you know, make this project succeed. And it's a red right now. And then you kind of check in with every individual person and their thing is a green. And you're like, how can you each individually be a green, yet the status of the project is orange or red? Well, it's very simple. It's not because of the things that are owned. It's because of the things that are unowned. It's because as an old colleague of mine said, if you were to stand and draw a circle around yourself, you would call that circle your job responsibility. And then if you lined up all the circles in a grid of all the people who are employees of the company, you would find that there are gaps between the circles, right? Who owns the gaps? You know, when projects fail, it's because the thing that's failing that's between the gaps. It's because everybody thinks their job is only the thing they own. And I'm like, no, no. Great leaders of any dimension, individual contributors, managers, you know, all the way up to the CEO, step into the white space where the gap is and deliver what needs to get delivered and stop thinking about what your job responsibility is and think about what is needed to get to success. So that's what I mean when I say step into the
white space. Give us an example here. Let's say for a CEO or for a CXO, what would I...
Yeah, here's a good example of a CXO. Let's just say product and tech. Let's say you have a chief product officer and he's delivered the specs. You have a chief technology officer who said, like, well, I delivered the specs. And I'm like, and then you look at the OKRs and you're like, okay, well, you deliver, you know, you, I mean, this is the simplest of examples, but you're like, you say you wrote the right spec, you say you delivered the spec, and yet, you know, the product that just released to our enterprise customers was buggy. All right, so we can all just sit here and say, you guys both are perfect, right? But like, you're together, you're failing. You know, that might be a time I'm making it up where I'm the chief product officer, and even though it's not my responsibility, theoretically, I might say like, hey, you know what I'd love to do? Can we just get both teams into a room and do a, you know, and literally let's just get everybody in a room all together, like, you know, park our egos at the door and let's just go through step by step, you know, what were our strongest points and what were our failures in delivery? Or, you know, should we, you know, think about like what's failing in our QA? But like the key about stepping in the white space delivery isn't to point fingers at someone else. That's very easy. That's very easy to say, like the thing is to say, hey, guess what? I'm not talking about your blame or my blame. Can I just like, I'm happy to take the action item of like, can I just call us all together? Like all of us together in one room. I'm happy to create an agenda. I'm happy to go field from everybody what they think their ideas are and create the doc that we can discuss. Like those are all examples of like, it's not my job as the head of product, but if we failed to deliver this project that, you know, was a high quality product that wasn't buggy in our first release, then it kind of doesn't matter whose job it is. Can we just get that job done? So sometimes it's uncomfortable to say like, well, somebody needs to own that thing and we think we're stepping on somebody else's toes, but you can just be the facilitator, right? Nobody says you're saying you did it, I did it, you need the answer. But when people don't take the opportunity to go step in, then those things just aren't done. And, you know, and everybody's worried about looking perfect in their own role. And as a CEO, I love the people who step into the white space. I'm like, those to me are extraordinary leaders. They kind of are like, yeah, it needs to get done. So I got it done. I'm like, okay.
Got it.
Awesome.
It's about owning the interface, sort of the stuff that slips through the cracks and sort of taking
ownership.
Absolutely.
It's about taking ownership of the whole, not just your piece. And whatever that requires you to do, be a facilitator, be a facilitator. Be a note taker, be a note taker. Be the person who asks the question, ask the question. Like, but not from a place looking to blame the other person. Most of like, what does it need to get from here to the finish line? Like literally, what does it need to get, what needs to happen for it to get over the finish line?
The other thing that struck me in the book, Sukhinder, was you used the metaphor of finding the wave from the movie Finding Nemo. Our younger son, as a matter of random trivia, is nicknamed Nemo. His name is Nirmal. We call him Nemo at home.
That's awesome.
But I think what I found interesting was at every point in time, there's always this inside out versus outside in piece, right? One is about saying who you are, what really drives you, and that leads you to a set of choices. It's a bit like strategy, right? Is it capabilities driven or is it opportunities driven?
Yes.
What's been your reflection on this whole? Is it, do you see a tension there, following the current versus following your heart? How have you married the two?
Well, I think you just made the perfect analogy. In strategy consulting, any five forces model would tell you to measure both, right? It's only to your point. Maybe something sometimes is in conflict, but often you're just basically rating them all and saying, like, if I had to add up the probabilities. Obviously, probabilities are maximized when we enter environments that are, you know, have momentum, and they maximize our skills and our ambitions. Yes, everybody would wish for that all the time, right? Sometimes we're faced more with choices where we really want to do this, but, you know, the indications of the macro environment are it's not the right thing to do. So I think the point is any smart risk-taking involves an outside-in and an inside-out perspective. And if anything, I would say our failure mode in risk-taking is most people tend to believe far more that risk-taking is in the micro moves they make, you know, entirely. And so remember, I am a fan of micro moves and micro choices, but I think we want to be in anticipation and response, not feeling like we are like 100% of the universe is in our control. It's not. What's in our control is our anticipation and our response. Anticipation, response. So I believe in those kind of micro moves. When people are like, hey, I'm just going to out execute my way out of this problem, I'm like, oh, really? Like, you think it's all about you? Like, you think you can just, I'll tell you what, like, you know, Silicon Valley is a saying, like, when good teams meet bad markets win. You can keep trying to out execute your way out of a hurricane, it's still a hurricane. So then a micro move is not going to do you any good. You want to bolt your doors? Go ahead and try. You need to like get in your car and like literally drive 100 miles an hour and outrun the hurricane. Like no micro move is going to save you. The best thing you can do is like try and figure out when a hurricane's coming and with what force. So I think that that is the analogy I would give. I think that it's not an or, it's an and, but I think that more often I see executives believe they can out-execute their way out of anything. And I often see this in the strategy room where people will be like, well, if we just execute better, if you guys just execute better. Yeah, sometimes it's about execution. And sometimes literally it's about like, are you in the wrong market? Are you, do you have momentum? What are the headwinds that are coming your way that you may not be able to outrun? So I think we need to have a lot of confidence in our own agency to make moves, but we need to be absolutely looking for things that increase our probabilities of success from the outside.
And just a couple of questions before we wrap up, Sukhinder, I'm mindful of the time as well. As you think about your journey, you speak about specialization, generalization. You suggest go broad. And then
deep,
go
broad, deep. Yeah, deep, broad, deep. I think I was like, yes. Broad, yeah. Deep, broad. Yes.
Yeah. So give us a sense of how that's played out for you and how you see this sort of the macro choice of going deep versus broad.
Well, I would say to people like, look, you know, if I've ever read Malcolm Gladwell, you know, one rises and becomes an expert on 10,000 hours of something. And for me, that was sales and biz dev, right? So you find an area. By the way, when I say broad, when you come out of school, you don't know. Mostly it's about building skills and discovering what you love, right? And for me, yes. I discovered I was both good at sales and I loved it. I learned financial literacy and financial analytics, and I learned a lot of it. Like I wanted to master it. And then once I became competent, I really loved the numbers too, right? I didn't know I loved the numbers, but I do. So I learned those two things about myself, and I ended up in a career in mostly sales, then business development being quite a nice hybrid between, you know, needing to be able to assess opportunities financially, but also pursue them like sales. So that's great. Okay, so you master something and you can ride quite high on a functional dimension. But if you say, hey, I want to be a CEO, let's just think about that for a moment. Or, and I want to be an entrepreneur, I'm like, okay, that's about learning the skills you don't know, right? So by its very nature, you will have to step off the deep track at some point and take a risk to learn something you don't know. Like literally, it turns out that it's not like just literal. Research also shows that in today's day and age, the best path to a CEO ship is a winding one. Literally, CEOs, you know, and executives who take time to broaden their skills are more likely to ascend than those who just stick to what they know. So by its very nature, I would say if you want to grow, right, doesn't that mean that at some point you encounter a set of problems that you have no experience in? That is the very definition of like growth, right? It's hard to grow if you know everything. So I'm a big fan of, you know, building mastery, certainly. That's how we build our superpowers. It's how we build our reputations. It's where we build our networks. That's all true. It's where we can show increasing accomplishment and efficiency. And then at some point, you know, what we've achieved mastery, you sort of, your growth curve stops, right? And if you want to really become a broader, more capable leader, a CEO, an entrepreneur, a GM, you know, you will have to ultimately, you know, go learn the things you don't know and, you know, take the risk to take on a new role, take on a new task, take on a new responsibility. And I think the difference often between men and women is, you know, men will reach for that opportunity they're not qualified for. And actually, you know, that works in their favor. And women often won't reach for the opportunity they're not qualified for because they're worried about failing or, you know, or whether they're, you know, what's the word they use? Like, you know, whether they're ready. And I'm like, you know, if you waited for when you're ready, growth never happens, right? So my belief is, you know, yes, build specialization by all means. But then, you know, your growth happens where you stretch yourself to things you don't know and learn how to master new skills.
Hmm. The other thing that struck me when I read the book and the way you make choices, you say it's not so much about the outcomes and payoffs, but really who you become as a result of that choice. And sometimes we forget to take cognizance of that. How have you thought about that? And once again, with the wisdom of hindsight, what's the nuance here?
Well, I would say to people, maybe a sentence that doesn't make sense. I would say the reward for risk is not reward. And people are like, what? I'm like, no, the reward for taking a risk is not reward. And I'm like, it's not the reward you originally imagined. It's something else. So when we take a risk, I always say a bigger risk, when we make a bigger choice, right? You're not done. Let's say you say, I want to go build a $100 million business. Okay. And you say, I'm going to go choose this new role where I can have the opportunity to build a $100 million. Not to $100 million today, but I want it to be, you know, that's the opportunity ahead of me. Okay, you make that choice. Well, guess what? Now you have to make a bunch more choices to make that dream come true, right? It's not like we are done once you made the choice to join. Now you're in like the pursuit of that macro reward and you're making lots of micro choices, right? Micro, smaller, bigger over years. Like, you know, you don't know if you're going to get that reward. But as you keep pursuing this reward, what are you doing? You're building agility. This is what I would say to people. You're in a sphere, right, where you're committed to that choice. You're committed to that, trying to the pursuit of that reward. So, you know, you wake up, you try something, it doesn't work, you try something else. So now you're in a feedback loop all the time of making choices. And as I say, every time we're in a feedback loop, if we can create learning or an outcome, we're developing some kind of impact. You're creating impact. Maybe you get to 10 million, 20 million. Maybe you build a stellar team. Maybe you build a respected reputation in the industry. By the way, you're not at your big goal, but you still are building impact, right? So whether or not you get to the big goal, I don't know. I don't know if you're going to get it to 100 million. I don't know if you're going to hit 120 or 80. I don't know if your division will open or close. I don't know if you'll get there and then the company will decide to shut it down because it's not meaningful. I don't know. But what I know is in the pursuit of that goal, you're building impacts and outcomes. And you yourself are building an agility and a confidence in your capacity to anticipate and respond. And that is what we become when we, you know, when we embrace risk. So I can't guarantee if you get the reward you originally thought. What I can guarantee you is if you pursue choice making and risk taking as a muscle, you will gain agility and confidence. And the correlation of agility, and by the way, grit. And if you were to look at any of the research on the predictions of like, or the correlations of agility, confidence, and grit to long-term success, there's high correlation. Right. So now you're acquiring these skills that are the most coveted skills for any new job you're going to go get. Whether or not you ever reach your original goal or not, that's what I mean when I say the reward for risk is not reward. It's who we become, which ironically is correlated to longer term reward.
Got it. So this podcast is titled Play to Potential, Sukhinder. As we wrap up, what does the phrase mean to you?
Well, interestingly, I think it's a very complimentary phrase to choosing possibility, right? Because what it really says is we're reaching every day for something that isn't yet ours. And that pursuit of that as a process has its own rewards. So if you say play to potential, I'm sure you don't say to people play to potential once. You'd say, no, keep playing to your potential. That's where the magic is. I'd say keep choosing possibility. That's where all the fun is.
Lovely. Sukhinder, pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. I hope you found the conversation purposeful. A couple of messages before we wrap up. If you're interested in receiving short 2-minute extracts of wisdom from the podcast, served up once or twice a week, consider signing up by sending a WhatsApp message at +91 85914 52129. I repeat, the number is +91 85914 52129. Here, we share short extracts across the various guests we've had at the podcast over the 5 years. Do also take a moment to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or wherever you consume the content. It might seem like a repetitive ask, but trust me, it makes a big difference in people discovering this podcast amidst a lot of noise out there given the boom in the podcast supply in India in the last few months. It also helps us attract good quality speakers who care about some of these metrics. To know more about what's in the podcast archives and the advisory work I do, you could just visit playtopotential.com. That's PlayToPotential.com. Thank you, and hope to have you tune into one of the subsequent conversations of the podcast. Bye now.